This hour's Top Stories Iran's foreign minister calls on France to honor its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal and stop abiding by U.S. sanctions on Tehran. Syria accuses the U.S. of hypocrisy by claiming that human rights are a priority in its foreign policy. And Jordan's former crown prince says he is under house arrest as authorities detain several high-ranking officials in an alleged plot against King Abdullah. Welcome to the World News. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has called on France to abide by its commitments under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. In a phone conversation with his French counterpart, Zarif urged Paris to take a constructive stance during next week's meeting on preserving the landmark agreement. He also called on the French government to stop implementing what he called illegal U.S. sanctions on Iran. For his part, Jean-Yves Le Drian welcomed the resumption of talks on the nuclear accord known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Le Drian urged Tehran to halt its rollback of nuclear commitments. Iran says it is opposed to a step-by-step revival of the deal, adding that Tehran's definitive policy is to have all U.S. sanctions lifted.
Iran and the other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, held virtual talks on Friday to discuss the fate of the agreement. During the meeting attended by China, Russia, France, Germany, and Britain, along with Iran, the signatories agreed to hold in-person talks in Vienna on Tuesday. That will be part of the meetings of the Joint Commission of the Nuclear Deal. Later, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki claimed there will be indirect talks with Iran in Vienna.
These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran. And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA, and the sanctions relief steps the United States would need to take in order to return to compliance.
Tehran will hold no direct or indirect talks with Washington before it removes all anti-Iranian sanctions.
According to the immutable guidelines set out by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, any outcome of the joint JCPOA commission meeting, which is based on the notion of step-by-step removal of sanctions, is unacceptable. According to the guidelines by the leader, the Islamic Republic will only return to its JCPOA commitments after the removal of all U.S. sanctions and Iran's verification of the move. The Islamic Republic will not hold any mediated or unmediated talks with the U.S. before all sanctions are lifted. Just as the U.S. left the 2015 nuclear deal without negotiations and imposed sanctions on Iran, it should now remove all sanctions without talks.
Iran signed into the 2015 nuclear deal and committed itself to limiting its civilian nuclear program in exchange for removal of all nuclear-related sanctions against the country. That was meant to ensure Iran benefits economically from the accord. But those benefits were scarce and fully evaporated after the former U.S. administration withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and imposed unilateral sanctions against Iran. Analysts say all Iran is saying is that a once-negotiated deal does not need to be renegotiated.
The deal was the result of negotiations. So the negotiations have already taken place. The deal tells all sides what they're supposed to do. So the Americans know exactly what they're supposed to do. There's nothing to negotiate. If they want the deal to work, they have to implement it. But if they want to take bits and pieces and think that they can gain concessions from Iran, Iran is not going to do that.
Almost 3 months into the Biden administration, Washington is yet to right Donald Trump's wrongs on the nuclear deal. Tehran is clearly seeing through Washington's empty rhetoric and is calling for action. On Friday, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi told a virtual meeting on the nuclear deal that the remedial measures Iran took after the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal are reversible, but only after the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions and its verification by Tehran.
Investigative journalist Tony Gosling believes what we hear from the West regarding the JCPOA is mere rhetoric and there is no concrete action to salvage the deal.
Well, he's exactly the same as Joe Biden. Biden, in his election campaign, was also saying, we want to rejoin the deal. Now he's saying, oh, well, Iran has got to jump through various hoops before we'll sit down and talk about rejoining the deal. So he's completely shifted the goalposts, exactly as Macron did. I think really with many of the particularly European leaders, it's literally words, nothing more. And these words are for the domestic population to reassure them that their leaders are not maniacs. I'm afraid what we're seeing in the actual results of what the leaders are doing once in power, and now, of course, we're in the situation where Macron could make some very important moves, really separating out the European policy from the US policy. But actually, it shows me that he's beholden to the same financial elite, the Western financial elite, the transatlantic Bilderberg financial elite, that Biden is. And these people are not acting independently. They're really just agents for an international financial war party based here in the West that actually wants to see tension and conflict in the Middle East, because it believes it can grab resources as a result, and also it can make money from war. That's the problem. Nobody wants war except those that make money from it, and they do.
The Syrian Foreign Ministry says the United States is the largest violator of human rights inside and outside its borders. In a statement, the ministry dismissed the U.S. State Department's annual report on human rights as a document of lies. Damascus says the report only contains allegations against countries that do not agree with the policies of the United States. It says the allegations about Syria are all taken from reports of terrorist organizations, their supporters, and financiers in the region. The Syrian Foreign Ministry rejected the use of human rights for achieving political objectives. It insisted that the U.S., which has a history of human rights violations all over the world, is in no position to talk about human rights. Now, Jordan says it has detained several high-ranking officials over involvement in an alleged plot against King Abdullah. According to the country's state media, Bassem Awadallah, a longtime confidant of King Abdullah and an advisor to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and a member of the royal family, were among those arrested. The Jordanian military dismissed reports that King Abdullah's half-brother, former Crown Prince Hamza bin Hussein, was arrested and noted that the prince was told to cease actions that would hurt the country's security and stability. This is while the former Crown Prince has said in a video that he is barred from leaving his house and that his bodyguards were arrested. The United States and a number of Arab nations have voiced support for King Abdullah over the developments. Political commentator Michael Springman says former Jordanian Crown Prince Hamza bin Hussein is likely to have been victimized due to his opposition to the corruption in the country.
The best I can get out of it is that the former crown prince, who's been confined to his house apparently, was extremely critical of the old guard of corruption in the country, and he's met with a lot of resistance because of his criticisms, and that may well play into this. Jordan has been fairly stable as regards countries in the region, and it has been a key country for the United States in training terrorists and helping train American soldiers in the region. The monarchs of the region, and if you want to include Egypt and his the dictator Sisi, he's been supporting the king of Jordan, as well as has Bahrain, which is not exactly a bastion of democracy. So I think that they're all holding together in the hopes that if one falls, it won't lead to a domino effect and bring the rest of them down.
Security has been tightened at the U.S. Capitol following a deadly attack on a police checkpoint on Friday. Workers were seen installing high razor wire-topped fencing and additional concrete barriers around the Capitol building. Reinforcement comes one day after one police officer was killed and another one was injured in a car ramming incident. The attack is the worst security threat at the Capitol since the January the 6th deadly protest, when supporters of then-President Donald Trump overran the complex. The violence left five people, including a police officer, dead back then. Brazilian health officials have registered nearly 2,000 new deaths from COVID-19 as the pandemic continues to wreak havoc across the South American nation. Latin American country, which has the highest daily death toll, that is, in the world, has so far recorded more than 330,000 fatalities. Coronavirus cases in Brazil also rose by over 43,000, bringing the total to nearly 13 million, Brazil remains the world's second worst hit country by the pandemic in terms of deaths and infections after the U.S. Elsewhere in the Americas, Mexico's coronavirus death toll rose to more than 204,000 out of some 2,250,000 confirmed cases. The Mexican government has, however, said that the real number of cases could be significantly higher. Thousands of people have taken to the streets in the German city of Stuttgart to protest the government's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Police said the demonstration was almost peaceful, but face mask requirements and social distancing rules were mostly ignored. Authorities nevertheless decided to let the demonstration go ahead. Last month, German officials announced that the country would be placed in a strict Easter lockdown, but withdrew the decision days later. According to the Robert Koch Institute, the number of confirmed coronavirus cases in the country has increased by over 18,000 to more than 2,873,000. The tally showed that nearly 77,000 people have died of the virus. In a move likely to stoke tensions with Russia, Ukraine says it'll hold joint military drills with NATO in a few months. We discussed that issue with our guests in our news review program.
Right, Ukraine's military says it will hold joint drills with NATO troops in a few months' time, a move which is likely to stoke tensions with Russia. The Ukrainian armed forces said drills will involve more than 1,000 military personnel from at least 5 NATO member states. And Russia has expressed the opposition to such a move, saying any deployment of NATO troops to Ukraine would lead to further tensions near Russia's borders. NATO has been against what it calls a big Russian military buildup near eastern Ukraine. This after Moscow warned that a serious escalation in the conflict in Ukraine's Donbas region could destroy Ukraine. And now joining us for this news review is John Bosnich, political analyst, joining us out of New York, and Mr. Jim Kavanaugh, founder of The Polemicist, joining us out of New York as well. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here, I guess. Jim, we'll start with you. Hope you're safe and doing well out there. This thing seems like it's getting out of hand, and it's a lot more serious, and there are a lot of players involved. The Germans involved, the French are involved, Washington is involved, Russia and Ukraine. It could turn out to be a mess. Your thoughts on this?
Yes, this is a very serious situation now, I think. You know, the Ukrainian President Zelensky signed a decree on March 24th, essentially committing to retaking Crimea and the city of Sevastopol from Russia. And, you know, he's being pushed very hard by the fascist groups who are, you know, not letting up at all. He came into power on the basis of, you know, mitigating the conflict with Russia, but it's gotten worse. So in response to that, the Russians are pouring troops into Crimea and on the borders of eastern Ukraine. They're not about to allow that to happen. Even in the context of the drill with NATO, Zelensky, said this is going to be, we're going to drill for defensive actions and we're going to drill for offensive actions to retake our territory in Crimea and Sevastopol. So it is a very high tension now. The 4 Ukrainian soldiers were killed in a conflict last week. The ceasefire has been declared pretty much dead by American commanders. And the Russians have said that NATO troops coming into Ukraine will be a disaster for Ukraine. Now, in terms of a temporary exercise, maybe, but any kind of stationing of native troops in Ukraine is not going to be accepted by the Russians. So the Ukrainians and the Americans have backed them on this, are determined to take back Crimea. And that is just not going to happen. The Russians are not going to allow that. And the tensions now are at a very high point, and somebody is going to have to back down. And it doesn't look like the Ukrainians or the Americans and the NATO countries, as you say, that are involved with this, that they're putting themselves in danger.
Your initial thoughts on this, John?
Well, once again, we're entering into the Alice in Wonderland version of reality, which is standard NATO policy. First of all, any reference to so-called Ukraine's military is a misnomer. There is no such thing. It's a U.S. junta state placed in power, a U.S. junta regime placed in power through an illegal coup d'etat paid for by the American tax paupers who had to pay $5 billion to stage a coup in a place that most Americans can't even find on the map. That's point one. Point number two, the Ukrainian military is replete, full of young men who've been drafted against their will and who surrender at the first combat with irregular forces in the Donbas region. I've personally sent from my own news agency in Eastern Europe two reporters to the region who've been on the front lines and have seen streams of Ukrainian troops coming over to surrender to avoid the battle. The idea of this rump state, rump pseudo state, in fact, taking back Crimea, which was actually Russian in the beginning, from Russia, is a bigger, let's say, NATO wet dream than Taiwan conquering mainland China. This is totally impossible. This is the, let's say, drug-influenced, it couldn't other be in any other way, drug-influenced dream of some crazy Dr. Strangelove kind of generals in the Pentagon. There is no chance. It's suicidal, and it's actually insane.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. Pleasure to have you both. John Bosnich, political analyst, joining us out of New York, and Jim Kavanaugh, founder of thepolemicist.net, joining us out of New York as well. Gentlemen, stay safe, and thank you. That's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Normal service in government hospitals in Nigeria have been affected following a nationwide strike action by resident doctors. Danjuma Abdullahi has an update on the situation from Abuja.
Most government hospitals have remained largely empty because of a nationwide strike action by resident doctors who constitute a large percentage of medical doctors in government hospitals in Nigeria. Consultancy rooms have remained empty because of the absence of medical doctors to attend to patients. Doctors' union officials said they are tired of the government failing to live up to its promises of settling their salaries and other benefits on time. Representatives of the Nigerian government met with labor leaders behind closed doors in a last-minute effort to avert the strike, but apparently the meeting ended in a deadlock. The government appealed to the doctors to consider the damage their withdrawal of services will cause to Nigeria's health system. But the resident doctors said the government should keep its several promises. This strike is coming at a challenging period, especially with the COVID-19 pandemic, with only about 800,000 Nigerians vaccinated in a country with a population of close to 200 million. Nigeria has 163,000 COVID-19 cases, out of which 2,038 people have died so far. The doctors' union said all the resident doctors at the COVID-19 centers have joined the strike and withdrew their services. This doctors' strike is in progress just when the Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is receiving treatment in a London hospital. According to union officials, close to 16,000 resident doctors are participating in this strike, which is indefinite. Most of the resident doctors are specialists who provide important healthcare services, especially in emergency wards. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The Guardian published an article about Trump's new official website with the headline, Donald Trump uses new website to rewrite history of his presidency. The Guardian calls out the language Trump's site uses, describing his actions and accomplishments that are listed as being hyperbolic. Beyond omitting a number of his failures and follies, the Trump site also attempts to deflect blame as well. Dear listeners, we have prepared an article for you in this regard written by Chris Walker Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Trump's new official website attempts to rewrite history and gain online clout. Stay tuned for more. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has launched a new website that promotes himself heavily as a magnificent leader, failing to contextualize that ambitious claim with the numerous scandals, two impeachments, and hundreds of thousands of deaths from coronavirus that occurred under his tenure. Trump's site masks the difficulties he had in office while describing his supposed successes in positive ways. But many observers have noted that the site, viewable at 45office.com, appears to be also a vainglorious attempt at rewriting the history of the past 4 years. The office of Donald J. Trump is committed to preserving the magnificent legacy of the Trump administration while at the same time advancing the America First agenda. The site's main landing page states, hinting that the former Republican will seek to continue influencing the U.S. political scene for some time to come. News media across the web have panned the site as being one-sided and misleading. The Guardian published an article about the website with the headline, Donald Trump uses new website to rewrite history of his presidency. The Guardian calls out the language Trump's site uses, describing his actions and accomplishments that are listed as being hyperbolic. Beyond omitting a number of his failures and follies, the Trump site also attempts to deflect blame as well. For example, while discussing his leadership during the coronavirus pandemic, the site makes it seem as though all responsibility for U.S. deaths rests solely with China. When the coronavirus plague arrived from China, afflicting every nation around the globe, President Trump acted early and decisively. This site claims, disregarding the fact that Trump spent weeks falsely claiming the virus would go away on its own, and subsequently downplayed the seriousness of COVID-19 throughout the remainder of 2020. More than 400,000 Americans died from the virus while Trump was in office. Numerous studies and former health officials that served within his office have contended that his inaction on the pandemic likely led to hundreds of thousands of unnecessary deaths. The About section for the site, at just under 900 words, reads like a love letter of sorts for the former president, again highlighting his supposed accomplishments while neglecting to mention his failures or wrongly deflecting blame to others. President Trump never wavered in defense of our values, our families, our traditions, and our freedom, the website claims. However, Trump's actions and statements as president often did run counter to many Americans' families and values. He regularly engaged in racist rhetoric, including telling four congresswomen of color to go back to their own countries before criticizing his governing style. Meanwhile, he sowed division and hatred of undocumented immigrants and other marginalized groups. Trump's actions in his final month in office, too, were largely antithetical to the oft-observed peaceful transfer of power between administrations, as he engaged in pressure campaigns toward state officials throughout the U.S. to defy the will of voters after losing to now-President Joe Biden in last year's presidential race. He also sought to disrupt the certification process of Electoral College by encouraging his own Vice President, Mike Pence, to reject the results, despite Pence not having the actual constitutional power to do so. Trump's new website, besides being a concerted attempt to spin his record, appears to also be an attempt to reestablish his online presence. The site is part of Trump's efforts to reconstruct his digital presence after essentially being deplatformed after January Capitol insurrection, Axios' Sarah Fisher noted. Trump has been banned from all of the major social media websites, including Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, following his inciting statements on those platforms after a mob of his loyalists attacked the U.S. Capitol in January.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and let us start the day by reflecting on an aphorism on creation from the Prophet's 12th infallible successor, the Imam of the Age, Abu Saleh al-Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. Truly, the exalted Allah is the one who created all forms and apportioned the provision, because he is not a form, nor is he embodied in a form. Nothing can be compared with him, and he is the all-hearing, all-knowing.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, we send our peace and blessings upon all the prophets of Allah, subhanahu wa ta'ala, and especially the last of them, Muhammad al-Mustafa and his progeny, and those companions who followed their path. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life here on IRIB English Radio. We're talking about psychological diseases, dear brothers and sisters, that we might have within ourselves or in our society. And we mentioned the power of faith and how faith and reliance upon Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala can help us and rescue us from a troublesome life. If you live in the ghettos of US, Canada, European countries, Africa, that reliance of faith in God can rescue you from those slums and ghettos. And this likewise goes for the one who is wealthy and rich and lives in the best suburbs possible of those cities. How many times have we not seen people from the ghettos elevating themselves and reaching high levels of confidence and spirituality and being leaders of a community and of a nation? Do recall our dear brother Shaheed Malcolm X Rahmatullah Alayh, who was from those ghettos and who prevailed against all odds and finally drank from the glass of martyrdom. Do recall his grandson Elijah Shabazz, who also became martyred and was among one of those Afro-Americans who had a troublesome life. May Allah's mercy be upon all of them. Do recall all of those, and also do recall those who were wealthy, but that wealth did not help them, did not rescue them from taking suicide, from taking their own life. Why? Because they had the lack of faith in God. Thus, the noble and glorious Quran says, in God's remembrance and reliance are at rest the hearts of those who have faith and do righteous deeds. Chapter 13, verse 28. In another verse, it says, it is He who sent down tranquility into the hearts of the faithful. Chapter 48, verse 4. The noble Quran considers steadiness and security to be the characteristics of those whose hearts are full of faith.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact all focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact all focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Mental peace, dear brothers and sisters, it's a very, very profound thing. Let me give you an example to make it tangible. Imagine that you are in a battlefield and missiles and bullets are coming towards you. But even in that situation, dear brothers and sisters, you feel inner peace and no fear can penetrate you. Didn't we have those kinds of people in the 8-year war in Iran? People who put their lives in the palms of their hands and went towards the battlefield with tranquility. And they even prayed in those ditches that were as a shield against those bullets and missiles. They prayed there, and God knows about their tranquility. Now, in a lower level, imagine that you are in a traffic jam. You have noise and sound pollution and air pollution, people screaming and shouting in the honks of the cars. Now, can you exercise there to reach a certain serenity? Don't get irritated. If you can exercise in these situations, they're not battlefields, but they can be your battlefield. That would be your jihad. If you can take those golden opportunities or circumstances in the society that you face on a daily basis, people shouting at you, someone being rude towards you, someone breaking the line in front of you, and so on and so forth. If you can take those opportunities and exercise and try to control your emotions and not reach anger, have anger management, have serenity, you will see that sooner or later you will reach higher levels of well-being, of tranquility, of mental peace. The Noble Quran says mental peace and security are qualities of those who have faith and who have not drawn a veil of wrongdoing over their faith. Chapter 6, verse 82. Another verse says, lo, fear and sorrow do not affect the friends of God. Awliya Allah. Chapter 10, verse 62. And what a beautiful statement from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which I will repeat and end this program with. Lo, fear and sorrow do not affect the friends of God. Chapter 10, verse 62. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala elevate all of us, and may we sooner or later reach the ranks of the friends of God, awliya Allah. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. Soul I need. Soul I need. All I need. Soul I need. All I need. Oh, oh, oh. All I need. To be all soul I need. And I know that you see how much you need. You mean to me, 'cause your love is all I need, to be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me.
Your love is all I need.
Thank you.
John Hadley was born in Texas in 1968 when the United States was fighting the Vietnam War. He was one of five children. His patriotism prompted him to drop out of school and join the Army. After basic training at Fort Benning in 1989, he was assigned to the Army's 101st Airborne Division. He was then deployed to Operations Desert Shield and Desert Storm in the Persian Gulf that were aimed at pushing Iraq out of Kuwait. Compliance and his leadership abilities earned him respect, and he was dispatched on various missions. He took part in many missions, including in Panama, Korea, and Germany, which all brought him the Henry Caro Leadership Award. He also won numerous medals and awards thanks to his leadership abilities and courage during those missions.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
He was then deployed to Operation Iraqi Freedom 2 as sergeant for the first time in 2004. The operation codenamed Iraqi Freedom 2 brought Hadley many accomplishments. After his success in the Tikrit operation, Hadley was sent to Baghdad in 2006 as commander of the U.S. Army Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 18th Infantry Regiment, 1st Infantry Division. Alpha Company's area of operations lay in southwest Baghdad, one of the most active battlefields in Iraq. The U.S. mission was to promote stability. They were supposed to distinguish ordinary people from terrorists and detain terrorists and send them to jail. In late March 2007, soldiers from the company were patrolling on the outskirts of Baghdad when they got fired upon. The soldiers went to the position where the shooting came from. Nobody was there, and the attackers had gone. The soldiers kept patrolling. After nearly 1 hour, the unit came upon an Arab man. Startled by the patrol, he dashed across the street and disappeared into a doorway. The service members went through the doorway. On the inside, they found a group of frightened women and children and five men. The women were crying. The men were positioned facing the wall, professing their innocence. No one was armed. A quick search turned up a single Kalashnikov assault rifle with two loaded magazines, the standard household allowance in Iraq. More search turned up a bulletproof vest, a cell phone, electrical wires, and ammunition. It was unclear if they belonged to the men. At about that time, Hadley said to one soldier, Mayo, "How do you feel about offing these guys?" Mayo told the rest of the soldiers, and they burst into a bitter argument. Some opposed the idea. Hadley finally said he would kill them himself, and that he did not need help from anyone. He had made his decision. Cunningham was opposed to Hadley. He radioed the Alpha Company's headquarters and reported the situation. Minutes later, the headquarters ordered Hadley to report the number of the detainees. After he learned Cunningham had reported this to the headquarters, Hadley swore at him and called him a coward. The unit had to take the men to the headquarters. The commander told him they did not have sufficient evidence to hold them, and they had to be released. He told his own superior, Hartson, and said they had to punish the Iraqis themselves. Hartson opposed this and told him to turn them over to the Iraqi police. The Humvees started moving. Some thought they were going to an Iraqi police post to turn over the detainees. After Hadley's GPS was switched off, only Cunningham's remained to represent the mission on the army screens. Darkness gathered. It was Hadley's vehicle that showed the direction. The ride lasted 30 minutes. Hadley directed the patrol into an open field, where he called for a halt by an irrigation canal. Some of the soldiers switched to night vision goggles. Hadley, Mayo, and Leahy went over to the back of the vehicle. Cunningham could see them. When he went towards them, they were ready to kill the Iraqis. Hatley once again demanded Cunningham to participate in the killing of the Iraqis, but Cunningham said he was not down for it. They took the detainees to the edge of the canal, where they killed them by shooting them in the back of their head.
This is what I told the parole board. You have to come to grips with the fact you have a man of such integrity. He's not going to come tell you what you want to hear. He's going to tell the truth. And truthfully, he didn't commit four murders.
Several months passed, and things were normal. Cunningham could not forget the killings. By now, he had decided to report the crime, but he feared for his and his family's security. The army has no mechanisms in place that would have whisked him away and protected him. For precisely that reason, war crimes are more common than is generally supposed. They are simply too dangerous to report. When Hatley and the Alpha Company learned Cunningham had decided to report the killings, they tried to pressure him. First, they isolated him, and then they tried to deplore Cunningham by making fabrications against him. But Cunningham did not give in to the pressure and dragged them before a court-martial. Hatley and other commanders thought Cunningham was going to save himself from the charges they had fabricated. But Cunningham revealed the killings at the court-martial. Thus began a process, rare for our era, in which a serving soldier, not families, not victims, and not the press, dragged the army into confronting a war crime.
I mean, if I were in the parole board, I would think it would make a difference that you have six members of Congress that are passionate about this case, as well as several others. We're part of what we call the Justice for Warriors Caucus, and we're going through trying to address issues like this where we've got servicemen and women in prison for a variety of reasons that need to be reviewed.
All those 12 people, including Hatley, Mayo, and Dr. Leahy, were questioned. After several hearings, the court came to know everything. In April 2009, the U.S. court-martial in Vilseck, Germany, issued its verdicts. Thus, Hatley was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 20 years. He was demoted to the rank of private and was dismissed from the army. Dr. Leahy and Mayo, who abetted Hatley in the killing of the Iraqis, each got 20 years in jail. 2 months after Hatley's trial, Jess Cunningham came to the end of his enlistment. Honorably discharged from the army, he returned to civilian life.
A soldier from Central Texas has spent the last 11 years of his life behind bars at the military prison at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The crime that he was convicted of is horrendous.
Social media were not a help, and they called him a traitor and an enemy while describing Hatley as a patriotic hero.
The kind of support that was out there for John Hatley and the kind of guy he is, I can't see that any decision here would be anything other than to release him.
And to add to that, too, John has a 20-year impeccable combat record.
Cunningham may be the last soldier to report crime in the military, but one cannot say for sure that Hatley will be the last war criminal in the U.S. military. During 14 years of the Alpha Company's mission in Iraq, many Iraqis got killed. And some of them might have been killed by people like Hatley. But the pressure the security firms and the media under their control exerted on Cunningham will make other soldiers think twice before reporting misconduct and crimes.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Canada likes to see itself as a benign global actor, but its extensive history of military intervention tells a different story. A $70 billion upgrade of the Canadian Navy, now carried out by Justin Trudeau, will strengthen its capacity for military action as a U.S. sidekick in world affairs, says Yves Engler Ryder in an article titled, "The Canadian Government Talks About Peace, But It's Investing in War." Stay tuned, please, for the details. Canada has marketed itself for many years as a peacekeeping nation and benevolent international actor, but this appearance is only plausible if one's point of comparison lies directly south of the border. The Canadian state has long had a privileged relationship with the United States and Britain, the two leading empires of the last two centuries. In reality, its appearance as a tender-hearted broker in international affairs is a public relations sleight of hand. Ottawa has deployed its relatively sophisticated military in action far more often than most people recognize. Canada is now preparing to equip its navy with new frigates at an estimated cost of $70 billion, $100 billion over their life cycle. As part of the largest single outlay of public money in Canadian history, the 15 vessels will be kitted out with a mixture of offensive and defensive weapons, in a mix never seen before any surface combatant. Thus far, this expenditure has not elicited any paramilitary opposition. The 7,800 metric ton vessels have space for a helicopter and remotely piloted systems. The frigates have electronic warfare capabilities, torpedo tubes, and various high-powered guns. They will also possess naval strike missile harpoons that can fire missiles from a distance of 185 kilometers. Most controversially, the surface combatant looks set to be equipped with Tomahawk cruise missiles capable of striking land targets up to 1,700 kilometers away. The U.S.-based firm Raytheon has only ever exported these Tomahawk missiles to the UK. If the Royal Canadian Navy acquires them, it will be the only navy besides the United States to deploy the missiles on surface vessels. Canada's new frigate will be brimming with missiles, is how the drive recently described the surface combatant vessels. In the article, War Zone reporter Joseph Trevithick concludes that the ships now look set to offer Canada an entirely new form of maritime power projection. Over the past 3 years, Canadian vessels have repeatedly been involved in belligerent freedom of navigation through international waters claimed by Beijing in the South China Sea, Strait of Taiwan, and East China Sea. To counter China's growing influence in Asia, Washington has stuck its oar into long-standing territorial and maritime boundary disputes between China and the Philippines, Malaysia, Vietnam, and other nations. As part of these efforts to rally regional opposition to China, the U.S. Navy has engaged in regular FON operations, which see warships travel through or near disputed waters. Canadian frigates have also regularly patrolled the Black Sea, which borders Russia, Bulgaria, Turkey, Romania, Georgia, and Ukraine. In July 2019, HMCS Torino led a four-ship standing NATO maritime group exercise in the Black Sea. Soon afterward, it participated with 24 other ships in a NATO exercise that included training in maritime interdiction, air defense, amphibious warfare, and anti-submarine warfare as part of an effort to send a strong message of deterrence to Russia. During the 2011 war on Libya, Canadian vessels patrolled the Libyan coast. Two rotations of Canadian naval vessels enforced a six-month blockade of the North African country. On May 19, 2011, HMCS Charlottetown joined an operation that destroyed eight Libyan naval vessels. After the conflict, Navy head Paul Madison told Ottawa defense contractors that Charlottetown played a key role in keeping the port of Misrata open as a critical enabler of the anti-Azafi forces. A month before the March 2003 U.S.-led invasion of Iraq commenced, Canada sent a command and control destroyer to the Persian Gulf to take charge of Task Force 151, the Joint Allied Naval Command. Opinion sought by the Liberal government at the time concluded that taking command of Task Force 151 could constitute being legally at war with Iraq. Throughout the 1990s, Canadian warships were part of U.S. carrier battle groups enforcing brutal sanctions on Iraq. And in 1998, HMCS Torino was deployed to support U.S. airstrikes. During the first Iraq war, Canada dispatched destroyers HMCS Terra Nova and Athabascan and supply vessel Protector to the Persian Gulf before a UN resolution was passed. Historically, the Canadian Navy's influence has been greatest near to home. There is a long track record of naval interventions in the Americas. As military historian Sean Maloney states, since 1960, Canada has used its military forces at least 26 times in the Caribbean to support Canadian foreign policy. In addition, Canada planned three additional operations, including two unilateral interventions into the Caribbean states. At the request of Grenada's government, Ottawa deployed a vessel to the tiny country during its 1974 independence celebration. As Kai Schoenholz and Richard Melanson describe in their book, Revolution and Intervention in Grenada, Canada and the UK also sent three armed vessels to St. George to shore up the Eric Gehry government, which faced significant pressure from the Grenada left. When the 23,000 U.S. troops invaded the Dominican